Future-proof extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Now, often we cover on this programme subjects around the field of neuroscience. We talk sort of objectively about things that happen to people, but we rarely speak to the people who live with the conditions we talk about. And so today is a real treat because we're going to be speaking to Sadie Dingfelder. She's the author of Do I Know You, who is living with lots of different neurodivergent strands, I suppose you could say. And I suppose it's best to let Sadie explain herself. So Sadie, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. I have to say, I really enjoyed this this book because it seems like you have such a unique experience of the world. And what's lovely is that we sort of walk hand in hand with you as you realize that you are not like people in lots of different ways. So maybe you might tell me about the first time you started to figure, which you kind of explain in the book, you started to figure out that your brain does not quite work like everybody else's.
Yeah, the first time I really started to realize this is I was grocery shopping with my husband, and all of a sudden he went rogue. He's throwing all this junk food into our cart, and I had to stop him. So I grabbed a peanut butter jar out of the cart and I brandished it at him. And I said, "Since when do you buy generic peanut butter?" And he looked back at me and he was horrified. He looked scared, and it was really the expression on his face, not his face itself, that clued me into the fact that he was not my husband. He was just sort of a similar looking guy. And the fact that I was faster to notice the wrong label on a jar of peanut butter than the wrong face on my husband really gave me pause. And and ironically, I am a science reporter, so it just didn't occur to me that I might have a rare neurological condition known as face blindness, which I actually knew about. I'd written about it before. And
what? You'd written about face blindness, but at no point did you think maybe I have that. So you in the book, you say you sort of started to ask questions, and then you sort of came across a test, which is in the book, which is sort of face blindness test. If you look at our Twitter feed, you can see an example of what that might be. To me, it is glaringly obvious. Even the supposedly harder test is glaringly obvious which face is which. But tell me what you experience when you look at a face.
Well, you know, when I look at a face, I think that my subjective experience is probably pretty similar to most people's. It's really just I forget it the second I look away. And I'm really amazed that, I mean, you know, the thing is that it's not that I learned that I was terrible about faces. What I really learned is that everyone else is exceptionally good at remembering faces. And the thing that blows my mind is when someone can meet you at a cocktail party and then see you the next day and remember you, you know, and that's, can you imagine if I gave you like a seashell and then the next day that seashell, like, I don't know, I guess if it was in your hallway, you might notice it. But if you, it seems like you wouldn't be able to pick that seashell out of a lineup the next day,
no.
Right? But you can do that with faces, and it's because you have a whole chunk of brain devoted to recognizing faces. You don't have that for anything else, any other visual recognition task.
It's called the face. They call it the face area, right? This is like a part of the brain where it's really devoted to being able to figure out who's who. And obviously, from an evolutionary point of view, that's really useful. But now it's less useful.
I would say it's even more useful than it used to be because we have to remember so many more people. We used to be in, you know, little hunter-gatherer tribes, and you only had to remember maybe 150 people. And now you have to remember so many more.
Yeah, I guess. But then, like, fewer of them are likely to kill you. So there's a trade-off. When you learned that you had this face blindness, what did you do?
Well, you know, I was at work at the time, and I really did not expect it. It was a real shock. I worked at the Washington Post, and there is no crying at the Washington Post, right?
Is there a sign?
There should be
no crying.
Yeah. Everyone's very tough. And I'm not really that tough. And so it felt really shocking to me. It was almost like I was watching a movie and there was a surprise ending that caused me to have to like reinterpret the entire movie, except that instead of it being a movie, it was just my entire life. And I got on Facebook and I asked some old classmates if they'd noticed anything about me, and they, you know, I had been very unpopular as a kid, and I managed to turn it around in college, but I was so, so lonely as a kid. And I asked people, you know, if this was why they hadn't been friends with me or if I didn't. And people said, oh, like,
no,
they thought I was.
No, you were just annoying.
You were just annoying. Yeah. No, no. I mean, what people said was really eye-opening because I didn't realize that I was snubbing people all the time by accident. Mm. And I am, and I still am. It's one of those things that people just don't tell you. And it's very easy to go through your life thinking you're doing fine with face recognition when you're not.
Absolutely. And you know, over and over again, you might see people, they may make a face at you, go, when they expect you to stop. And I mean, like, even if you know someone and you recognize their face, there's a whole social interaction that you've got to get right. Otherwise, you can put a nose at a joint. You don't even recognize, you don't even know if this person's a stranger or a friend. Like, if you had your, you know, your brother and four other people that looked kind of like your brother in the room with you, would you be able to identify him?
You know, context clues really get me pretty far. And I think that's true with a lot of face-blind people because there's so many other ways to recognize people. I met a little girl who had memorized all of the people, all of her classmates' shoes somehow. And that's how she could tell everyone apart. There's voices. Hair is really helpful. But I mean, so the Cambridge Face Memory Test, which is, you know, pretty much the gold standard for diagnosing prosopagnosia, the way it works is they cover the people's hair and you're just stuck with this little like face. And it's very hard. I mean, could I recognize my brother in a lineup of similar looking dudes? I mean, I've failed to do it before. So,
right. Yeah.
I can do it sometimes and sometimes I can't. So it just depends on the lighting.
As a science reporter, did you find, did you dig deep into the neuroscience of this? I mean, because it seems like there's quite a good bit of research around this very niche, as you say in the book, very niche neurological condition. Loads of people are studying it.
Yeah. It turns out that prosopagnosia is neuroscientists' favorite disorder because there's this little chunk of brain. It's called the fusiform face area. It's the size of a lima bean. It's above each of your ears, though it's the right one in most people that does the heavy lifting. And so neuroscientists love this because, you know, they can do single neuron recordings, in some instances with humans and non-human participants, subjects. And it's really like the most specific thing going on in the brain. And so it allows you, it becomes almost like the Rosetta Stone for other types of brain functions, including other types of object recognition. Cause, you know, how do you recognize a chair as a chair when every chair is different?
Yeah, I remember reading Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, I think it's called. And like, if you haven't read that book, it's incredible because he details these use cases in which people really can't tell a thing from a person, which when you think about that is so funny. But I wanted to talk to you specifically because I was trying to think about the most sensitive way of putting this. you have an embarrassment of neurological conditions. You are blessed with an embarrassment of... you also have something called severely deficient autobiographical memory. Can you first tell me what that is and then how you knew you had it?
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I discovered is that if you have one neurodivergence, you probably have others. And
really?
In fact, yeah. Like there's so much overlap between things like autism and ADHD, dyslexia, face blindness, topographical dysgnosia, which is just the fancy way of saying gets lost all the time, left-right confusion. Like you really get, it's like a pick three situation at least.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's because it seems, I mean, I think our categories are very broad and they don't actually capture what's going on at the physical level of the brain very well.
Yeah.
So I think in the long run, all of these categories are going to sound very old fashioned, like I'm having the vapors or something.
So severely deficient autobiographical memory is what then?
Yes. So people, there's two types of memory. Well, there's a lot of types of memory, but two types of memory are autobiographical memory and episodic memory and semantic memory. And who there are people who can remember like everything about their lives. Like they can tell you, you can say, oh, what happened on July 4th, like 1992? And they'll say, oh, I was wearing a polo shirt and it was very hot. They know all of this contextual detail. And also a magic sort of thing, it seems magic to me anyway, with episodic memory is that people can actually do this mental time travel where you can re-experience some of what you saw and felt and tasted and smelled maybe in your past. I did not know that this was a thing that people could actually do. And apparently it's a thing that almost everyone does. But if you can't do it like me, and if this sounds very outlandish to you, then you also have severely deficient autobiographical memory, which means you store your entire life as a story or like as facts. And so for us, it's almost like we just read a book about ourselves. Do you know the famous...
you can't experience that as a memory.
Right.
You just know what happened as in you can like you have the facts, but not the experience of it. You can't remember what a waffle tastes like in the South of France on a summer's day or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know
if I can do that either. Is that a common thing that a lot of people can do?
Yes. And there's remembrance of things past by Proust that there's a very famous scene where he bites into a Madeleine and it takes him back to his childhood. And, you know, I always thought that was just colorful writing, but apparently this is a thing people can do. So you're in the club too, you think?
No, sorry. I'm not in that club. I actually do. Okay. If I eat something and if I have a particular taste, it will absolutely bring me back to a time and I'll remember something. So sorry. You're on your own.
Okay. Most people have a balance between episodic and semantic memory.
Yeah.
And actually, as you get older, the balance moves towards semantic memory and you lose the sense memories.
And so the meaning of something becomes more, because what I'm really bad at is remembering the specifics of what's happened. I remember that something's happened, which means I often steal people's cool stories by mistake.
And so a
friend of mine was cut in line at Rick Rubin's mansion by Coolio. And I tell that story like I was cut in line by Coolio at Rick Rubin's mansion. But we were both there, but I didn't see Coolio, apparently. I was somewhere else. I think I was dancing with Mila Jovovich.
Wow. I didn't hear about this party.
It's the only cool story I have. And now I think about it, maybe I wasn't dancing with Mila Jovovich. Maybe that's something I would remember more clearly. So as I say, I remember some things as if they happened to me, but they didn't. So is that my memory changing over time? Because you spoke to a lot of neuroscientists in the writing of this book, trying to figure out how memory works. And it's, you know, when you talk about, you know, pulling apart these details, I often see, you know, the face of my producer looking confused as he tries to figure out, do I think of things that way? Like, because memory and thought and feelings are so subjective, is it a very difficult thing for people to carve out into these disorders? I mean,
yeah, it's so like for, I mean, early in psychology, in the history of psychology, people there was a lot of introspection going on and people tried to make a science out of it, of sort of capturing their mind at work. But there's a famous quote that is by, I think, William James, that trying to see your own mind at work is like trying to turn up the gas really fast to see what the darkness looks like. So it's one of these things that's very paradoxical, very hard to do, maybe impossible to do. And then there's the problem of, you know, science is all about objectivity. And so how do you objectively investigate something that is subjective by definition? And so there's lots of cool ways that we gave up. No one tried to do this for quite some time. And then only recently, basically with the advent of fMRI, but other clever techniques, scientists have been verifying or disproving what people say about their inner lives. with the memory things, it's really interesting. They do, there's all these tests. Like I did a test where I had a tour of an art museum and I had to remember, they asked me all these questions about, did I see, you know, picture A before picture B or vice versa? And these kinds of things require you to sort of walk back through the space mentally and re-experience things because it doesn't make a good story. It's like, yeah, not a good story. So since basically I can't remember any, like I really fail these tests and so do other people with SDAM.
How on earth did you write a book then? I mean, you know, it seems like you fail to remember a lot of things. You can't recognize a lot of things. Because the book is really interesting. How did you manage to go about that enormous neurological task?
It's so interesting. I mean, I realize in retrospect that I'm a journalist, not in spite of my weird brain, but because of my weird brain, because it is a coping mechanism in and of itself to I take a lot of notes. I am constantly telling stories because that's the only way I can record and remember my own life. And so it's actually a little bit easier, I think, for me to write down my life story because it's already in a story format and it already kind of hangs together and makes some sense.
There's a piece in the book where you talk about your father and his feelings about how you may have or may not have gotten these neurological conditions. Could you tell me a little bit about what your feelings are on that?
My dad and I have a great relationship, and I'm so grateful that he allowed me to write about him a lot in my book. I didn't give him a lot of opportunity for feedback. And I feel like it's just sort of the family values is not to navel gaze. Like the worst thing you can do as a Dingfelder is to think about yourself too much. And so he was just against this whole project. And so as I would come to him with these things and I'd say, you know, I don't remember my entire childhood. He, you know, really pushed back on it. But I eventually think I won him over with just the mounds of evidence I had. So in terms of like what happened and the sort of chain of causality, it's hard to know. But what I think happened was I maybe got a little bit brain damaged while I was being born because of, I was in a very country hospital and maybe I had a little hypoxia, which is like oxygen, not getting quite enough oxygen at a moment. And so that actually resulted, I think, in my first problem, which is maybe my most foundational issue, which is called, technically it's called amblyopia or strabismus, but I call it stereo blindness because it makes more sense because basically I only see out of one eye at a time.
What?
And so, yeah. So my brain, this is actually not totally uncommon. It's one of the more common conditions in the book, but yeah, normal people, neurotypical people integrate their two fields of vision into a single three-dimensional scene.
Yeah.
Whereas my brain suppresses vision from one eye or the other. And so my world is actually constantly jumping back and forth. And I didn't realize how different everyone else's experience of vision was.
Yeah. I mean, wow. I don't know how else to say it because it sounds really, there's a lot going on.
I was totally neurotypical until I was 39. I thought I was completely average.
This is so crazy. And this comes out in delightful personal stories and some really interesting interviews with scientists in the book. It's called Do I Know You? It's written by Sadie Dingfelder and it's available now. Sadie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was so fun chatting with you.
You too. If you're living with face blindness or some of the things we've talked about in that interview ring a bell, you can let us know. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us. We're @NewstalkScience.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on Newstalk.